Hello, welcome to Literally from the North Shore. We're glad you are tuned in. We continue today with Connie Ellis's reading of Shelter Half by Minnesota author Carol Bly. We pick up now where Connie left off last time.
Chapter 8. People suppose Dr. Anderson was excellent in his profession, family medicine. They had to believe that since no one wanted to make the 11-mile drive to Cullah to see the doctors there. St. Frissy people told one another what a good man Anderson was, the way parents tell children that Santa Claus is always full of goodwill. Nobody told their children that Santa Claus got tired and short-tempered from year-round holiday preparations. Still, something held them off a little about their doctor. It was his politics. It was not that he was Republican or Democrat or something else. It was that he was political at all. Dr. Anderson sometimes brought up miserable subjects that people needed, like they needed a poke in the eye with a sharp stick. They wanted him to live the life they lived, interested in his work, interested in his family. They felt sorry that his wife had died. He was raising two children alone. But if only he would stay on task, one person in all of St. Frissy approved of him completely. That was the chief of police. Stokowski's and Anderson's conversations with each other were usually horrible. Bad luck or bad human behavior were what brought them together in their work. What made them like and trust each other, however, was that neither of them tried to find any silver linings in any clouds. Neither of them tried to put a good face on any happening. They talked about the most grievous subjects. Of course, since they were a cop and a physician, with this major difference, casual pessimists, their professions gave them respect for accuracy. They had the habit of checking out whatever guesswork they had to do. They were exact rather than romantic. They shared an abiding hatred of such horrible human behavior as they came across in their work. What Stokowski knew was an eye-opener to the physician. What Anderson knew was an eye-opener to the policeman. They commonly met alongside yellow tape, in hospital hallways, in the holding tank at Cullah, in the St. Frissy Clinic's physicians-only parking lot. Neither of them ever had a deli sandwich at Denham's Bakery or a drink at the VFW post. They ate and drank in private. It was an early weekday afternoon. The inside back hallway of the St. Frissy Clinic was crowded, nearly shoulder to shoulder, with ordinary people, even the chief of police. People peered in from alongside the registration counter. Dr. Anderson was prancing like a teenager up and down the hallway, hugging his 16-year-old son, kissing him, never minding the boy's red face. Simon could have been killed a half hour earlier, but the boy had used his head and had a lot of luck, so his father was laughing and crying in the hallway of the St. Frissy Clinic. The med techs, especially the touchy, low-spirited one whom no one particularly liked, carefully backed away with their plastic cups of urine, and the two office nurses held their index boards close so that their nutty boss and his son wouldn't barge into them as they reeled and zigzagged past. Of course, it was wonderful that Simon Anderson had survived crashing a pickup with no brakes right through the huge north window of Denham's Bakery. Everybody had learned the details within a half hour. Of course, everyone smiled. Of course, people said that it was a near thing, but in the less voluble neighborhood of their upper cortexes, the six inner conversant layers of the neocortex, what people in their right minds call their heart of hearts, they did not completely admire their doctor for cavorting like that down the hall clinic. Okay, so Simon Anderson had not been killed. Simon Anderson, in his wisdom, had cut school that day, apparently in order to go into the auto lot right on Highway 53 and try out a second-hand Chevy pickup, which had come into Garris Autos expressly for brake repair. The onlookers, grinning and clapping, remembered being 16 years old. On the other hand, they did not all remember their own dads ever expressing this much love for them. These grown men's faces, despite their smiles, looked a little strained with envy. The previous few days had given Dr. Anderson exercise in most aspects of his practice. He endured each of the two smells he never could really accustom himself to, the fetor from the first tipping the blade into the chest to examine a rotted human body, and then today, on Monday, the classical pallid stench of semen on a battered patient. On Friday, Dr. Anderson pronounced on the body that had lain beside Minnesota 53 for 10 to 12 days, twice lightly shawled by snow. Animals or birds had eaten its eyes. On Saturday forenoon, Dr. Anderson had done the examination as a favor to the county M.E., who didn't sing in St. Fursey's ecumenical choir, and therefore had had the weekend away. The official cause of death was two blows to the head in the upper left parietal area. They could not have been self-afflicted. The body had been in intercourse before the head was struck. For the present, it would be held chilled until someone claimed it. For now, it was essentially a legal possession of the state of Minnesota. The doctor and the St. Fursey chief of police talked about it. Bernie Stokowski said that this particular murder looked like work by a very large organization whose resources, or you could say whose skills, included getting rid of any bodies it wanted to get rid of. "How do you know?" Dr. Anderson said. "The pattern was classical. Neither the body when in vivendi nor anyone else had handled any of deceased's clothes or shoes," the chief said. "There were no partial prints on anything. Human beings use their hands to get dressed. If they are dressing someone else, either alive or a dead someone else, they use their hands. Everything on the dead female had been wiped clean. Sunday school teachers do not wipe prints off young women." Earlier that same Saturday morning, between 3 and 3:45, Dr. Anderson had attended the delivery of a moribund baby. Its parents had refused any medical intervention throughout an unpromising and potentially dangerous pregnancy because they were practicing, they told him, the full power of prayer. Each of the four times the doctor had pointed out to them that the pregnancy was not good, they had smiled at him. Their smiles were the smiles of a fourth-grade arithmetic teacher. "If you don't understand long division today," such smiles say, "you will tomorrow." They were inspirited Christians tolerating a dim physician. The father had explained that both he and his wife were in personal relationship with Jesus Christ. The doctor took their smiles and their remarks like blows to the face. But he had heard worse. The baby lived for 3 minutes before it died. The next day was Sunday. Dr. Anderson had only rounds at the hospital. Rounds included checking on the mother who had lost her baby. He started off down the maternity wing, but turned back to pick up one of the nurses to go with him. In her room, the mother told him that she didn't like to be negative, but she had concerns. If her attending physician had been willing to pray with her and her husband the way they had four times requested, instead of allowing the devil to fill him with pride in his technical professionalism, they would not have lost their baby. Dr. Anderson raised his eyes from the clipboard of her vitals. He told her again how sorry he was that her baby had died. He returned to the nurse's station to fill out his report. The senior nurse handed him a cup of coffee without asking for it. She said, "I thought you handled that just perfectly, doctor." Her eyes filled and her voice thickened. "I've always noticed, we've all noticed, how gentle you are, too, when you have to blanket and hand over a dead baby to its mother. Like yesterday. I know it's your job and all, but not everyone's that gentle. Not everyone's that caring. We noticed." The other nurse, who was on duty that morning, returned to the station from a patient call. The doctor stopped scribbling in his codes and signatures and remarked, "You know an experience I've had?" The first nurse now decided it was time to cut the sadness. She said with a brightening face and a witty tone, "Of course I do. You have never delivered a baby yourself, Dr. Anderson." He said, "I have never attended the delivery of a healthy baby, handed it to its mother and then heard airplanes fly over and then had bombs drop on the hospital and kill the new mother and the baby. I've never had that experience." Both nurses stared. The younger one began to cry. He paid no attention. "No," he went on in his oddball, nearly languid tone. "Turns out I've never had that experience. I wonder if the president has ever had that experience." Now the one nurse wept in a florid, nearly vomitous way. The two nurses handed a Kleenex box back and forth very gently. Soon Dr. Anderson was done, so he lifted up the little Dutch door and left them. From the coat hooks, however, he overheard the senior nurse say, "I like Dr. Anderson a lot, but I really wish he wouldn't do that so much of the time, dragging in stuff. We had enough sadness around here this weekend. What with someone left dead out on 53 and then that dead baby, without him dragging in other stuff that hadn't got anything to do with anything." That was early Sunday morning. The Anderson kids had fried pancakes at home. Simon was an awfully good tenor for someone 16. Katie was a focused nature lover who would sit for quarter hours on end to observe a deer or bears. They were both such terrible cooks that their dad had to master his aversion to the burnt edges and running mucus of the pancakes. "Have seconds, Dad," they told him. "Here we made plenty." "Gee, kids, okay, seconds." The doctor got a beeper call at 10, but only to arrange a 72-hour hold for his repeat bipolar. One of his repeat husband's battered patients called, but called back 2 minutes later to say she sure didn't know what was wrong with her. She giggled. She guessed her head would come off if it wasn't screwed on. How could she have said anyone pushed her down the basement staircase when what had happened was the usual? She'd just lost her balance with a basket of laundry. And she bet even the doctor did dumb stuff like that once in a while. And she gave the good sport laugh, which he knew from the years of his practice meant she had decided on this version of the script. No one had delivered a baby. No one called from the hospital to say anyone was claiming the murdered woman's body. He was free to finish breakfast and eat his lunch with Simon and Katie, and even get in a full 1 hour nap, and still make it on time to the 3 p.m. chorus rehearsal. Now he was doing a Virginia reel up and down the hallway, didn't mind that Simon was embarrassed. He didn't mind that he thought he had a 1 o'clock appointment with someone, but absolutely couldn't recall whom. He couldn't feel any weight in his right white coat pocket, which meant he had again misplaced both his cell phone and the new stethoscope. Never mind. His appointment's nurse elbowed through the crowd. "Dr. Anderson, do you want to pick up?" She held out a wireless. He laughed and practically sang. "No, but I'll take it." He let Simon go, but said, "Don't leave." The show seemed to be over, so the crowd politely drew back a little to allow their doctor some privacy on the telephone. In the next moment, however, they heard him give a shout. Shout that was one part shout, 9 parts snarl. Nobody could resist eavesdropping. "You're saying what?" the doctor shouted into the phone. "Yes, I know who you are. You are saying that Simon skipped school and missed 4 classes? I believe you. I am sending him home for the rest of the afternoon, too, Principal. So he will miss whatever he's got for the afternoon, too. I am ordering up bed rest. You'd like to know why? I will be happy to explain it." "You what? You resent my tone? Listen, do you realize that my son could have avoided risking his own life by driving through a bunch of younger kids in the street? He could have done that. That's what people do, Principal. Whatever they're doing, they just keep on doing it. Never mind that they can foresee what will happen." But Simon didn't. Clinic crowd were utterly delighted. Even one of the techs, not the dour one, grinned. No one much liked the Culla High School principal, but up to this minute they had felt vague about it. Now they knew they'd always been right. The fellow so totally sucked. "Jeez, Dad," Simon said. The doctor held the phone away from his mouth long enough to say, "Pipe down, Simon. I want to look at your signs again." Back into the phone he said, "He could have done that, you know. Half the world just keeps doing whatever they're doing, even if they could save lives by doing something else. Not Simon. He made a 90-degree turn and drove through a building, so you know what? You know what's going to happen to that string of kids? They're going to grow up and go to your high school someday. Now I have to get off the phone and let you get back to your work." The doctor said to Simon, "I want you home on the couch or in bed, lying down. I will come check you after a while. Wait a minute. I don't want you there alone." "Oh, good," he cried and pointed at Arlene Straub, a woman he knew who was standing among the crowd. "Arlene," he shouted, "is today the day you clean my house? Could you take Simon home with you and stay with him?" His appointments nurse said severely, "Dr. Anderson, Mrs. Straub is your 1 o'clock, and she's already been waiting a half hour." "Go home," he said to Simon one last time. "If you feel even the least thing, dizziness, nausea, anything, call me." The chief of police came forward. He said, I'll drive him home, Doc. Dr. Anderson hugged him, too. His happiness lay all about him, as though he himself, some vessel of himself, had poured out. He rushed toward his nice cleaning woman. "I'm so sorry, Arlene. I wasn't thinking here." And he took her folder from the nurse. "Come on in." He pushed up the orange patient in lever. "Don't be cross with me," he said, following her in. "My son is alive, you see." His patient was far from cross with him. She looked at him with a face full of love. Her face also showed a fresh 5-centimeter bruising on both left and right side, with several days old dark black and blue in the preorbital area around each eye. Dr. Anderson began lightly touching her face. He figured the original bruise site was on the left cheek, but she had turned when struck there to the right, likely to stave off further blows to the left side damaged onto the jaw 3 months ago. Brachiophalanges had eaten the old blood, and scavenger cells in both cheeks were well into several days' worth of remaking blood. Destroyed hemoglobin gave one cheek surface a brownish green. He wheeled a little closer to Arlene and lifted her hands. The undersides of both arms were yellow, where they would have caught some of her husband's blows when she raised them to protect her face. Dr. Anderson set one assault on Arlene Strop at about 5 or 6 days prior, and new trauma today. He asked her a few desultory questions while he wrote on her sheet. She never paid any attention to his advice, but he always kept her in the clinic as long as he could. He kept half an ear cocked for an opening when he might talk her into making a charge and leaving the brute of a husband. There was no single reason that Arlene should stay to get beaten up every day. He peeped into 3 previous pages every 4 months or so. Arlene Strop, so far, had followed a conventional pattern. She always gave Dr. Anderson a specific, partial subject to advise her on. "Just look at the left side of my jaw, would you, doctor, please?" she would say. "Keep away," her tone always said. "Keep away from any holistic remarks about my life." Over the past few years, he had several times given Arlene Strop his shaky speech on the subject. "There is a law now, Arlene," he would say, as though it were nothing to do with him. He was helpless in the case, he would tell her. "I have to report such bruising as you have." He always offered it all in a very low-key tone, matching her typical lifelessness of voice. "You know what that means, Arlene? It means you have more people on your side than you know about. Not just me and my staff, but people with authority in Duluth." She never paid any attention. He didn't think it was money. His other battered wives needed to stay married for the husband's income. They had to feed their children. Not Arlene. She brought in the regular income they had. He knew she cleaned the elementary school and the St. Fursey Episcopal Church and a number of individual homes such as his. He himself knew of 4 people who had come for half days. In the way that word got around, Dr. Anderson knew that Peter and Nat Tenebrae, and he paid her $25 an hour, but another 3 of her employers, whom he knew of, stayed at $12 an hour, probably the rate they had hired her at years ago. Practical enough. They knew as well as Arlene knew they didn't have to pay more. She wasn't going anywhere. Everyone knew her husband couldn't keep a job. That lady was good and stuck. $12 an hour was fine. Arlene would actually save money by throwing Brad out, the doctor figured. What kept her in the abusive marriage wasn't hard to understand. First, if she tried to get out of it, Brad Strop would beat her up. The chief of police was a nice and very savvy cop, but she would get beaten up before Bernie ever got there. Second, even if the chief fixed up a restraining order on Brad, Brad would beat up Arlene, get put in prison for a while, then get out and beat her up again. The clincher reason, though, Dr. Anderson thought, was that Arlene was caged in her own ideals. She was married. She was a married woman. Whatever impenetrable fog of disrespect the rich and the near-rich of St. Fursey, and especially the women's church groups, let fall upon Arlene Strop, they couldn't take it away from her that she was a married and gainfully employed woman. She crouched in her marriage the way a live-caught mouse crouches in a humane trap. Arlene did not see it as a cage for holding prey ready for a predator. Today, Dr. Anderson's heart was so full of joy about Simon, he had to order himself to stay on task with Arlene. He let her talk. Even on this November day at 47 degrees of north latitude, she wore a print cotton dress. She kept one knee crossed firmly over the other, with the lower legs and ankles held together, then tipped to one side like a college girl on television. He was not sure whether her dress, the more pathetic for looking ironed, would be her clothes for cleaning houses, or if she did her cleaning in pants, but had put on this dress for her appointment with him. He knew she loved him. How could she not? He didn't take it personally. In a culture so full of cruelty as the United States was, people loved anyone in the helping professions who was civil or just minimally kind. Of course she loved him. It was as they sat there, he trying, as usual, to conjure up some way to convince her to leave Brad. He caught the floating feature of semen. That smell changed everything. She always came to his office fresh bathed, only force at the noon hour, so she could scarcely keep her appointment, could have made her come to him with her husband's seed spilled on her. The repellent odor gave him a new idea. "Open your mouth, Arlene," he said peremptorily. "No, wait a second. Is your jaw okay enough now so you can open your mouth wide without any discomfort?" She opened her mouth. He said, "Yes, like that, but wider." "Now," he said almost harshly, "say ah, ah." "Good. Now listen carefully, Arlene. Say ah this time, just the same way, on the same note as I say it." He sang ah very loudly. She imitated. "Good," he exclaimed. She looked at him as though he'd lost his mind. She tried to shrink from his handhold. He had taken hold of both her hands until several minutes ago and was still holding them. He let go. "Now," he told her, "you say ah on that same note, and I am going to start out with you. Then I will change my note, but you keep yours. As I raise my voice, don't slide up with me." He took his note, and she picked it up. For a quarter second, they held it together. He at his octave lower. Then he slowly went up a fifth. She kept her note. He cried, "Arlene, you are unnatural." He then said, "I was just going to suggest one more thing, Dr. Anderson." Noticed he was using the silky language of a family physician doing an internal exam. It was the language that said, "I know what I am doing is intrusive, but it has a purpose, and I promise this will be over in just a moment." "Just one more thing," he said. "Please take a good deep breath and let it out, then take another and let it out, then take another. Then sing the same note I sing the way you did before, and hang on to it until I stop singing completely." He smiled briefly at her face. "No, I have not gone crazy," he said. They each breathed in and out together, twice, and then took their note, which was the bottom of the same fifth they had sung before. They were both using ah as before. Then he jumped clean up a major third. Arlene held strong, so he rushed singing through the first bars of the Ode to Joy. He knew that whatever music she didn't know, she would know that melody. It was jammed into the culture as firmly as the national anthem. Even Arlene's repulsive husband probably knew it and loved it. He sang loudly. He cramped little consulting room with its glass of cotton swabs and its folded paper gowns and its skeletal heel rests and its posters about the difference between a bacterium and a virus, and its Norman Rockwell print of a white-haired physician with his stethoscope pressed on a doll's chest while a little girl watched. Dr. Anderson's consulting room blared with his sound. Then he, and no doubt she, too, ran out of breath. Silence. "Oh," his patient explained. He waited. "Please," he begged her silently, "please say something. Please commit yourself to some opinion or other." Silently, he begged her. "Oh, what?" Arlene said. "That was so pretty." But she added in her usually gravelly tone, "Dr. Anderson, why did you want to see my tonsils when I haven't got a sore throat? And anyway, you told me ages ago my tonsils were shrunk up by now." He said, "I want you to sing in the ecumenical choir," he said. "I can't sing with those kind of people," she remarked without any particular expression. He told her she had ear. She could hold a note even though other people very nearby were singing on a different note. He told her, without lying, that she had musical taste. There was nothing wrong with old Beethoven, he thought, a little wildly to himself. There was nothing wrong with Arlene for liking him. He told her the next rehearsal was Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock. He was going to get that music to her ahead of time. "Wait a minute, Arlene," he interrupted. "Do you read music?" "The words part, not those lines things," she said. She added, "Dr. Anderson, I can't sing with those people." He stood up. "You're right, not today you can't, but by Sunday you can. It's only Monday. I will get the music to you tonight." Her head came up fast. "Not to my house," she explained. "No," he said, "are you cleaning at my house this afternoon?" "At the school," she said. Then he would get the music to her at school. He was going to set up times to sing with her so she could memorize everything before Sunday. To himself, he said, "That little devil Simon who'd skipped school and put a pickup through the whole front of a grocery store, that boy was going to do a little work for the old man." He could do 5 half-hour singing practices at home with Arlene. He himself would sing on the melody to teach her, and Simon, who was in the tenor section anyhow, could do the tenor line, and Nat could take the alto and sit off to one side of Arlene so she would get used to hearing the opposing women's part on the left. Nat wouldn't give him grief about this because they'd do it during the main one of her 5 or 6 happy hours of each day. She liked music at any level anyway, drunk or sober, at least so far in her alcoholic pattern. She always came through for the ecumenical chorales. Dr. Anderson noticed he was fast crumbling back down to practicality after the passion of gratitude for his son's life. He explained that he would pick Arlene up on his way home from the clinic at 5:30 tomorrow on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. He had thought to himself, he wouldn't offer the Saturday, though. He'd done last Saturday for the coroner. He wanted a weekend off. He held the door open and held it for her. "I will have to ask my husband," Arlene told him. He said, "I come pick you up at your house, and either Simon or I drop you back home a half hour later. You don't have to ask your husband anything. If Brad has any concerns, he can ask me. Will you tell Brad that? Tell him that. I will be really glad to come around to your house, help him with any concerns he has about your singing." "Those people, though," she murmured. Now that he and she were out in the hall where they might be heard, she added, "Big shots." A tech in the appointments nurse hovered near. "Dr. Anderson," said very loudly, "we're using the Episcopal Church red robes this year, Arlene. I'll see you get one." He went on in such a loud voice she had to realize he actually wanted others to be listening. That nurse or two, a passing patient, a tech. Since we talked all the time about the ecumenical choir rehearsal, this was not a medical consultation. He followed her all the way down the hall toward reception. Still talking loudly, he said to the receptionist while helping Arlene strap on with her jacket, "We never saw Mrs. Strop here this afternoon. She was here about the ecumenical chorus. No meds." At last she was gone. He thought, "I will call Simon and see how he is. Where did I leave my cell phone, though?" He returned to pause at the door to the blood room. His least favorite of all the techs the clinic had ever hired was pulling a slide out of her microscope. Without even lifting her head, she said, "On the baby scale, doctor." He took up the cell phone from the soft flannel. "And your stethoscope's in the clinic jacket you left in the doctor's lounge. Right pocket." She clearly made her voice express as much disdain as she could. That medical technician had come to St. Fursey Clinic at age 20. She was the doctor's own fault. He didn't know anything about hiring, and he'd hired her. She must be only 22 or 23 now. He supposed she might still grow up to be a friendly or affectionate human being. He bet she might. Then he thought, that's not true. He bet she wouldn't. He bet she would stay the same. He wasn't a psychologist. He was a physician who had a family practice, but he wasn't completely stupid. Chances were she would go on doing what she was doing and being the kind of human being she was being. She would slouch through the other 3/5 of her lifetime just like that, with her taste for low-key bullying when a chance offered. People might hint to her about putting people down so much, but no one would tell her in a straightforward way to be more, say, kindly disposed, because she lived in the same work world Dr. Anderson lived in, where people took care not ever to come off as judgmental.
You've been listening to episode 10 of Shelter Half by Minnesota author Carol Bly. This book will run for 20 episodes through July 23rd. Be sure to tune in again for the next episode of Shelter Half.